I think we'll get started. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming so early. It's great to see you here. My name is Kate McAlee. I'm the Executive Director of the Women's Ordination Conference, and I'll be moderating the panel and our conversation today, addressing the topic of Catholic theologies, religious institutions, poverty, and violations of the rights of women. This is our contribution to the 68th Annual Commission on the Status of Women, with the priority theme of accelerating the achievement of gender equality and the empowerment of all girls and women by addressing poverty and strengthening institutions and financing with a gender perspective. The world is at a critical crossroads for gender equality. Globally, 10.3% of women live in extreme poverty today, and they are poorer than men. According to the reports, progress towards ending poverty needs to be 26 times faster to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals by 2030. So as the global community gathers to agree on actions, priorities, and investments that can end women's poverty and advance gender equality, this forum will consider the relationship between global poverty faced by women and the role of Catholic theologies addressing or perpetuating this reality. The tradition of Catholic social teaching has addressed issues of poverty, economic development, and global inequality since its founding documents in 1891. Catholic social documents champion the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and as an effective way to address war and poverty. This tradition has continued with recent documents that make explicit the connections between climate change, poverty, and consumerism. However, while the social tradition of the Catholic Church makes explicit references to human dignity and the common good, the Church and the Holy See often fail its own ideals on issues of gender when it comes to funding priorities and policy making. We see this as a most foundational, we see this most foundationally with the sacralization of masculinity, insofar as the male priest is associated with Christ based on biological similarities, thereby perpetuating patriarchy in public and family life, condoning violence against women, and obscuring the widespread poverty against women in the global south. Furthermore, the prestige and diplomatic influence and cultural influence enjoyed by the Roman Catholic Church and the Holy See make it a formidable justification for women's suppression. Year after year, we witness the Holy See's commitment to obstructing the promotion of gender-related rights in rhetoric and policy, denigrating them as merely ideological in essence and an affront to the traditional sex-divine roles in the family and the church. We maintain that the Sustainable Development Goals will founder unless it holds all members of the United Nations community to the same standards of dismantling any barriers to gender equality and promoting the full participation of women. Solutions to end women's poverty are widely recognized. Investing in policies and programs that address gender inequalities and boosting women's agency and leadership. Catholic women and the tradition of Catholic social teaching and feminist Catholic theology offer visions for addressing these concerns, and in particular, the relationship, interrelationship between gender, poverty, and climate change. So today we ask, what is the Catholic Church of the future and its role in addressing human rights concerns? And this session aims to explore these tensions and potentialities. So I'm honored to introduce our panelists who will take up these questions in theological, practical, and pastoral ways. First, to my left is Barbara Ann Cozy, a doctoral student in theological ethics at Boston College. She holds an MDiv from Santa Clara University. Barb researches sexual and family ethics, queer feminist theology, and political ethics. She's also a vice president of the Women's Ordination Conference Board. Next, we have Dr. Christiana Zenner, is associate professor of theology, science, and ethics in the Department of Theology at Fordham University, where she is affiliated with the Faculty in Environmental Studies and American Studies. Her research into emerging and established freshwater ethics as an Anthropocene conceptualizations and intersects with ecological theory, religious ecologies, developments in earth science, and the ecological turn in Catholic social teaching. Professor Zenner is currently writing two scholarly monographs titled Beyond Laudato Si and Anthropocene Science Fiction and Ethical Futures. Her prior book, Just Water, Theology, Ethics, and Global Freshwater Crisis, is taught in venues ranging from the Transboundary Waters Graduate Program in Oregon to Yale University. In addition, she is a co-editor of two volumes of Sustainable and Bioethics and has published more than 18 peer-reviewed articles. And on the far end, we have Sister Mary McGlone, who holds a PhD in historical theology, A regular columnist for the National Catholic Reporter and other publications, she is a sister of St. Joseph, a cardinalette, and currently serves on the congregational leadership team. Sister Mary has ministered in Colorado, Wisconsin, Missouri, Inca, and Punta, Peru, and currently serves for nearly 30 years as a theological consultant and friend of the Sister of St. Basil in the Great in Romania. And a fact I like to share about Sister Mary is that she attended the first women's ordination conference in 1975. So we'll hear from our panelists, and then we'll open it up to conversation and an audience Q&A. So Barb, we'll start with you. Can you break open our theme? Give us a sense of the Catholic theologies we're discussing and how they're oriented around the themes of poverty, alleviation, gender, and women's leadership.
Great. Thank you so much, Kate. And a thank you to Women's Ordination Conference for hosting our space today. Thanks to all of you for coming out on this early Tuesday morning. So like Kate said, I kind of want to center my comments around this term Catholic theologies and this idea of a plurality of Catholic theologies and the idea that theology is always inherently contextualized, highlighting where feminism and poverty might fit into this picture. And I'll end us with three questions. So the historical roots of the decentralization of Catholicity, I think, can really be found in the Second Vatican Council and methodological shifts in the mid-20th century toward doing theology inductively from the ground up. So Vatican II is relatively famous for the liturgical shifts, moving the Mass from in Latin to the vernacular, the common language spoken by the people, showing a church starting to embrace modernity and to understand that context matters. Catholic priests that appear as founding figures for Latin American liberation theology in particular are crucial for making a shift toward a contextual theology that centers the poor. John Sobrino famously changes the traditional Catholic idea of no salvation outside the church to no salvation outside the poor. Ecclesial-based communities in countries such as El Salvador serve as consciousness-raising spaces where lay people were empowered to read the Bible for themselves, and both church leaders and their communities started to do theology with the social issues that the community faced at the fore of what it meant to worship as people of faith. And so all of this plays a role in poverty and economic justice starting to become central to the Catholic mission, especially in countries in the Global South. The church at this time can be seen as a space of prophetic witness against corrupt governments, which is no more easily seen than in the murder of the Salvadoran Archbishop Oscar Romero while celebrating Mass in 1980, and the 1989 murders of six Jesuits and two lay women during the Salvadoran Civil War. However, at the same time, the approach to the church's mission for peace, poverty, alleviation, and social justice still has these tinges of patriarchy, clericalism, and hierarchical leadership. The emergence of liberation theology largely has its roots in conferences of Catholic bishops, where lay people and especially women are not present in the creation of documents and therefore Catholic theology. Maria Pilar Aquino is a feminist Catholic theologian who critiques Sobrino for lacking a gender analysis and therefore overlooking the situation of poor women in Latin America. In line with Aquino's critique is a budding field of Catholic feminist theology with figures such as Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza writing about patriarchy within biblical texts and exegesis, and Rosemary Radford Ruther famously asking, "Can a male savior save women?" to illuminate the harm and gender-based violence that associating maleness with God has had in a variety of global communities. Similarly, Elizabeth Johnson notes that the symbol of God functions, as she says, to keep women in situations of subservience and violence. In particular, within developments within Catholic feminist theology, I would highlight the work of the Circle of Concerned African Female Theologians, which takes an African feminist approach to critiquing African hegemonic masculinities and patriarchy in religious language and spaces, while also exploring peace-building strategies and strategies to empower women economically. fundamental to African women's theology is a connection between transforming masculinity in symbolic language and poverty alleviation. Mercy Odoyoye is known as the mother of African women's theology, and she writes in 1988 about Jesus's mother-like qualities as he suffers with the poor and oppressed. Odoyoye uses this framework to explore the idea of alternative masculinities to think of Jesus as both pro-women and champion of the poor. In my own work researching Catholic feminist ethics, I think in particular about the intersection between gender and sexuality and the violence that the Catholic Church enacts on queer and trans women and gender minorities. A growing visibility has shed light on the fact that many faithful identify as both queer and Catholic, even as the Church continues to hold harmful stances regarding LGBTQ dignity, and while suicide and homelessness and poverty rates amongst queer youth in the United States continue to be high. And indeed, at the forefront of my mind is the recent death of non-binary student Nex Benedict. The institutional church continues to hold a murky tension between Pope Francis, who regularly shares meals with trans people and has called for pastoral approaches to care for queer people, of course, amongst the news of allowing Catholic priests to perform same-sex union blessings. And yet the official teaching remained the same, and no out LGBTQ people are present in the ongoing synodal conversations regarding church renewal. In the way that diminishing the value of LGBTQ identity can be distinctly related to economic precarity and situations of economic and sexual violence, it once again is clear to see the connection between the theology that we do, in this case, the anthropology of what it means to flourish as human in loving relationships, and the extent to which human rights globally are able to be upheld for queer and trans women and gender minorities. So I certainly do not mean this to be a comprehensive overview of the different contextualized Catholic theologies that have emerged in the past 75 years or so. Ultimately, I hope to show here that doing Catholic theology matters greatly for questions of peace, violence and harm reduction, trauma-informed approaches to economic development, and poverty alleviation. Catholic theology in the 21st century is by no means monolithic, and a plurality of voices have emerged to show what imagining a feminist Catholic Church might look like. Following the history of theological development shows the impact that denying women roles in church leadership has had on the ability or inability of the church to be able to recognize and champion the gendered dimensions to experiences of global poverty. This opens a human rights dimension to the ongoing synodal conversations that are happening about ordination and women's roles in ministry. I will end by highlighting three themes or questions that I think that theological contextualization and the growing particularities within Catholic feminism ask of us that I think are particularly relevant for our conversations at the Commission on the Status of Women. Firstly, in a sort of sociological question, what is the relationship between the symbolic interaction and material situations of poverty and violence? Religion tends to exist in a discursive space of symbolic language and ritual performativity that articulates fundamental truths. And what I have reflected on here shows the ways that these symbols can be powerful means to catalyze social change and conflict transformation, or to contribute to ongoing situations of oppression, material poverty, and violence. What makes religio-cultural symbols and rituals effective partners for policymakers, activists, and advocates for peace? And when does religion become an inhibitor for combating violence and poverty, especially in a world of religious pluralism, where religious symbolic differences and sacred sites can and do play a role in conflicts between nation states and communities, as we are currently seeing to a certain extent in the situation in Gaza? Secondly, what role do religion and culture play in strengthening or weakening universal moral norms, such as women's rights? Is there such a thing as a universal Catholic identity or a universal womanhood? The presence of a multiplicity of particularized Catholic theologies pushes a theological questioning of fundamental categories in the same way that the global nature of the United Nations can make it difficult to define what feminism means and represents universally across cultures and experiences of gender. Here, I am influenced by the work of human rights scholars who champion ideas of embedded universalisms, or the understanding that our universal categories are always embedded in cultural and, at times, religious realities. I wonder if this can be a way to hold onto our universal understanding of human rights violations and its gendered dimensions while acknowledging the differences in women's experiences that exist. And thirdly, what does institutional legitimacy and the ability to trust the United Nations and or the Catholic Church to do right by women in poverty look like in the 21st century? How do major institutions cultivate trusting relationships with local communities? As a theologian in the Catholic Church, I think of the embraces of feminism mentioned here as promising avenues toward restoring trust in the moral dimensions of the church, as a champion of the rights of the marginalized and oppressed, including women who are located in situations of poverty, war, or violence. The Catholic Church is often portrayed as polarized on women's issues and queer issues in particular, but I wonder if this framing can sometimes obscure dynamics of power and the many women and gender minorities who have left the church and disaffiliated as a result of the church's moral teachings. And so I will end there, and thank you again, and looking forward to our conversation together.
Thank you so much, Carter.
Thank you. That was fantastic. I was taking notes, and I love those questions that you pose. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Thank you, Kate, for moderating our panel, and Barb for your remarks, and Sister Mary for what is to come, and to Walk for organizing and inviting all of us. So I, too, am honored to be part of this panel that considers women's experiences, Catholic theology, and ecclesial realities. And I speak to you today not as a Catholic feminist, nor even a Catholic woman, but a scholar who is a woman who is deeply familiar with the Catholic Church's gendered theology as it relates to ecological theology and ethics. And so in what I say next, I'm going to be presenting some of the ideas and frameworks that I'm working with in the book that Kate mentioned, which is called Beyond Laudato Si, which is slated to come out in 2025 on the 10th anniversary of Laudato Si. As the title suggests, Beyond Laudato Si, I think there are a few more things that can be said. So, it will surprise no one in this room to hear me say that the Catholic Church is not known for having a progressive stance on topics related to gender, or women specifically. Reams of scholarly analysis and activist legacies attest to how the theological, anthropological commitment to a strict sexual dimorphism, the insistence on the primarily procreative function of sexuality, the unique charism of women as nurturers, caregivers, birthers, and mothers, and the correlative gender roles in patriarchal and andocentric societies can in some cases be empowering and life-giving, and we all know examples of women who live into that. but they can also be defeating and constraining and negatively impact the lives of women and girls as well as gender non-conforming people. So I say all of this, like Barbara, recognizing and agreeing that Pope Francis has made some progress in his understanding of gay relationships, certainly relative to prior popes, that he has begun to think about sacramentality in relationship to trans people. These are also pastoral advances. But as Barbara pointed out, and no, we didn't plan this in detail, so this is great, the structure of theological teachings about gender and sex in the Catholic magisterium remains tightly wedded to narrow conceptualizations of the natural, which are committed, again, to sexual dimorphism, a tight linkage between sex and gender, and an insistence generally on heterosexual relations practiced only in marriage. And unsurprisingly, this anthropological framework of gender and sex too often manifests in sexism, androcentrism, heterosexism, patriarchal privilege, homophobia, transphobia, and a dangerously narrow theological dialectic that frames women in terms of their sexual function and their social function vis-a-vis men. a triad of options that tend to reduce to virgin, mother, or devil's gateway. And that's a phrase that I take from Natalia Imperatore Lee's recent book. So when Pope Francis released his ecology encyclical, Laudato Si, in 2015, he was hailed for his vision of interconnectedness, and rightly so. But it's also the case that ecofeminists, including Catholic ecofeminists like Yvonne Guevara, articulated and anticipated many of these ideas by several decades. Themes that ecofeminists raised well before Laudato Si include the concept of interconnection, the critique of unchecked economic forces and social inequalities, the recognition of creaturely relations, and a suspicion of hierarchical anthropocentrism linked for ecofeminists to a suspicion of hierarchical sexism and modes of androcentrism in society. So there is a substantial literature of expert quality that has been available on these topics for a long time. And so it is galling, I would say, that none of this is cited or noted in the encyclical Laudato Si. And I've spoken about this and written about it a little bit in other places. But you know, the deeper I get into working with and thinking about these realities, it just seems to me that the ethics of citation and thus the extent of the absence of women from these citations is really substantial. Unfortunately, of course, there is a well-honed and well-known tradition of regarding feminist and related theologies as external or supplemental to the actual project of theology. This is a long-standing and common error. Philosophers, theologians, the Catholic magisterium, and educational syllabi across disciplines frequently view feminist, ecofeminist, and other forms of social analysis as epiphenomenal to a body of knowledge, as if these are add-on approaches or standpoints that are supplemental to a static, pre-existent, universally true and applicable body of knowledge. This is a problem, and it is a challenge that contextual theologies bring to a presumed universal, objective, neutral, generally masculine norm. To quote ecofeminist Heather Eaton, ecofeminist theologies call for reinterpretations of the foundations of theology, as do feminist and ecological theologies. Or as I say, in relation to liberation theologies, in relation to a range of contextual theologies, the claim is not, oh, and let's tweak this to look at it from a perspective of a given social group, but how do these insights fundamentally change the structure of knowledge, the epistemology, as well as the methodology of theological reflection? Or as I like to say, feminist theologies are not just, quote, strawberries on the cake, end quote, so to speak. So let me articulate three ways that I see this problem showing up in Catholic theology and ecclesial engagements on poverty, and I'm going to be speaking especially about gender and water because that's one of the things about which I care deeply. But problem number one we've already mentioned, which is lack of citation, recognition, and engagement with ecofeminist scholarship and action. Okay, so we know that in Catholic theology, women are lionized as caregivers, nurturers, and life givers. But when do they actually have voice in the encyclical and other ecclesial contexts? Whether that's Laudato Si or its follow-up Laudate Deum. Women in these documents are spoken over, spoken for, ignored, or labor of various forms extracted as a supposedly generously given resource. And never directly engaged in their work. There is, I will note, a curious citation of Donna Haraway in 2023's Laudate Deum, which I will riff on until the end of time in Q&A if we want, but I'm going to just put that to the side for now. And, you know, I say this even as I recognize that some incremental progress has been made. Sister Natalie Beckhardt was appointed to a leadership role in the Synod of Bishops in 2021. The 2023 Synod on Synodality made some steps to address hierarchies in the Catholic Church. Think roundtables and women at them. How that issues forth in ongoing theology and praxis remains an open question. So that's problem one. Problem two is the lack of gender analysis in social, ecological, economic patterns, structures, and impacts. So if citation and inclusion is a problem, so too is the lack of specific gendered analysis and the huge literatures that now exist on these topics. In 2017, scholar Teresa Toldy noted that Laudato Si, quote, completely ignores the specific impacts, end quote, of various environmental and social degradations upon women. She says, rightly, that ecological problems are raised in Laudato Si as if they have no gender and no sex. There's a little bit of an exception pertaining to water, but we can get into that, and again, it's pretty flat. This is a problem, because in the last several decades, social scientific data has only amplified the substantive interconnection of gender concerns with environmental degradations. It's especially evident, again, with regard to freshwater supply and sanitation. For example, it has long been known that girls are more often the ones expected to stay home from school in order to procure water for domestic or agricultural uses, that girls' health and emotional well-being, as well as school attendance, are more dramatically affected than boys from lack of sufficient private washing or hygiene facilities, especially for menstruation. Big new report out last year from the UN and World Health Organization on that. And that sexual predation for women while gathering water or using shared sanitation facilities are dramatically higher for girls and women compared to boys and men. So, while it's good that the Catholic Church supports the idea of a human right to water and articulates that girls and women bear a special burden here, there is actually basically nothing spelled out about how that looks and no engagement with the social scientific or development literature on this. Rectifying these gender-based inequities will take more than an invocation of women's innate caringness or appeals to the chivalry or virtue of men. And this is precisely because relations of domination, coercion, abuse, exclusion, under conditions of patriarchy and water scarcity, are not readily ameliorated by appeals to individual virtue or self-managed efforts at reform. Instead, what is needed is the elimination of the conditions that render women vulnerable, and this includes theological presumptions of gender-based domestic roles. In other words, just because the magisterium is attuned to freshwater scarcity and its domestic impacts, this does not mean that the magisterium is changing its approach to ecofeminist interrelations. And instead, the danger is that the linkages between domestic water supply, homemaking and caregiving, and gender can instead be reinscribed. So then problem three is that patriarchy and sexism make for terrible eco-theology. In white Euro-American philosophy and theology, nature has often received a gendered pronoun, rendering nature with a capital N or the earth with a capital E as female. From Francis Bacon in the 17th century to Pope Francis in the 21st, the rapacious language of brute force has been invoked as a way of portraying the dynamics involved in subduing, conquering, sowing seeds, plowing and harvesting, and laying bare the munificence of the earth's riches for mining or other forms of extraction when oriented to human extractive ends. It is not a pretty legacy, and the language, the rhetoric, is often sexually violent. Yet, the vast majority of commentators on Laudato Si, just to take an example, and Laudato Si begins with this really forward imagery, gloss over the language of domination and feminization of the earth. And instead, and I understand the impulse here, emphasize the Franciscan language of communion and interconnection that recur throughout the encyclical. And like other commentators, I too have been tepid in the past in saying, wait, this is rapacious, incestuous, problematic language that is going on in the encyclical. So I'm trying to do better. That's the next book. But, you know, naming and correcting abusive characterizations is, of course, a type of ecofeminist work. And to uproot such language, such imagery of domination in the context such as that we find at the beginning of Laudato Si has been the work of ecofeminists for a long time. I'm thinking, of course, of Carolyn Merchant in The Death of Nature. I'm thinking of Ivone Gabara and much of her work, both historically and more recently. But one of the points I want to make is that this is not only, or it should not be only, or primarily, the work of feminist theologians and ethicists. This is a human problem. Mm-hmm. This is a representational problem, not just a woman's issue. So we all have responsibility for it. Indeed, far from being just a woman's issue, this kind of construction must be acknowledged and dealt with by all who would like to resist curiarchical patterns of domination, sexualized vulnerability, and exclusionary theological anthropologies. So everyone can get on board. You don't have to have the particular plumbing that the Catholic Church recognizes as female. It's a human project, after all, and it has everything to do with the caliber of our relationships with the earth and one another. Thank you.
Well, after those two, I suppose I'd say that I'm coming from the more practical side, the on-the-ground experience. When I was 5, I realized that no matter what kind of shirt some guy wears, chauvinism is an empty suit. So what happened was we were going to shop for summer play shoes. And my big brother said, "Why?" He said, "What are you going to get?" I said, "I'm going to get red shoes." And he said, "Oh no, girls wear blue. That's what the Blessed Mother wants." Well, I was sad, but I really didn't want to insult the Blessed Mother. So we're at the store, and Mom said, "Well, now, what do you want, Mary?" And I said, "Blue." And she said, "Do you really want blue?" I said, "No." And she said, "Well, why did you say blue?" And I told her, and she said, "You can get any color of shoe that this store sells." Well, that taught me more than something about shoes. From there, I got a tendency to be suspicious of anybody that said that girls can't do something that boys can. So I've brought that suspicion, which has grown over many, many years, to the work I've done in theology and scripture study. My time in Latin America reinforced my awareness of how dominating groups can focus religion and interpretation to their advantage. Now, I was there in the heyday of the blossoming of liberation theology, summer workshops with Gustavo Gutierrez, etc. So we know that women supposedly play small and hidden roles in the Christian scriptures. But that's interpretation. I've learned a lot from folks who don't know how to read, but really know how to listen and think and speak. I want to take one scriptural example that I've not heard anybody use before exactly this way. And that's John's story, kind of interesting, of the woman at the well, the water. A little note about John to remind us. John is full of symbolism that leaves as much unsaid as said. And that fits non-Western cultures very well. His gospel is a constant invitation to go deeper. So to reduce John's images to face value is kind of like licking the wrapper of a candy bar and leaving the chocolate on the bench to melt into a glob. Interestingly, John likes to tell us what time it is. In the beginning, it was dawn, it was dark, etc. So now the story. And I think there are interesting ways in which it connects with both the previous presenters. Jesus asks for water, and she responds with the antagonism between their peoples, the Samaritans and the Jews. They shared a religious heritage from creation through Moses and beyond. But the division came when conquerors came, and one group was in exile and another not. And the Samaritans were the ones who had immigrants coming in and influencing them with their theology, their ways, and there was a lot of intermarriage. And so good Jewish people knew that they were not pure and shouldn't be around. So there was that real separation. Now the scene, it was noontime. And I wondered why. Jesus asks for a drink, and she reminds him that they consider her impure. Now, she's representing Samaritans, and he's representing Jews. He moves into symbols and talks about God's gift of living water. She contests, in typical John fashion, real literally, you don't have a bucket. You're better than Jacob, who left us this well. So he talks about living water, and she asks for it. Now, what people latch onto all the time is when he says, go call your husband, she says, I have no husband. And he says, you've had five. Now, remember, she's representing Samaritans, and he's representing Jews. The Jews pride themselves on not having gone outside of the God of Israel. The Samaritans, with all of that influx of different peoples, had gone to different gods. So they're the ones who have not the one husband God of Israel, but five husbands or more. But what's happened here is suddenly all interpreters move out of the realm of symbolic truth and hit into the shallow waters of supposed historical fact. When she calls him a prophet, she flips back into that religious antagonism. Where is the right place to worship? And this is the setup for Jesus to say, not here, not there. It's not a building or a mountain, commandments or canon law. It's about being lured by the Spirit of God and caught up in the truth of what God wants for all people. Now think about this. Remember, it was noontime. A lot of interpretation has said that's because she was an outcast. Yep. And she had to go to the well when women didn't normally go to the well. John doesn't usually do that kind of thing. It was noontime. It was the apex of Jesus' ministry. It wasn't the beginning. It wasn't dark. It was noontime. So anybody who's demoted her to a floozy has solidified a way to miss the whole point of the story. That religious institutions are meant to enhance faith and to bring people in, not to exclude. So, you know, the thing is, some people can't imagine it. And that might be one of the biggest poverties there is, a lack of imagination of something bigger. Actually, Jesus even had to grow into that new imagination. If you look at Scripture, the only people who ever got him to change his mind were women. Mary at the wedding party, the Syrophoenician woman who challenged him to represent the God of creation, not just the God of Israel. And the woman who pickpocketed her miracle, touching his garment, she was the only person Jesus ever called daughter. He never called anybody son. The only person he ever called daughter. So machista interpretations have deformed our imaginations. Artists like Da Vinci taught us to imagine that there were only 13 males eating the Last Supper. And they were interestingly all on the same side of the table.
It was a panel. It was a mammal.
A mammal. But depicting it that way keeps it very safe to say that Jesus saying, do this in memory of me, was an ordination of certain kinds of human beings. But suppose that what we should do in memory of Jesus is give our very selves, our lifeblood, for the sake of others. That's what he was saying. He wasn't saying, change this bread. He was saying, change this world. Who risked being at the cross? The women, because they had already given up their lives for him. The guys could go back to fishing. The women had really gotten themselves outside of respectable society. So what happens when the imagination begins to change? I think that the folks who protested altar girls some 35, 45 years ago knew what they were doing. They realized that as soon as you saw women serving at the altar, reading, proclaiming the word, everybody's imagination was going to change and say, why not? Mm-hmm. Why not all of the roles up there in that sacred space? So now I think about different countries. My first and longest experience in another culture was in Peru. Just as I said at the time, liberation theology was mushrooming. At that time, our ministry was mostly working in priestless parishes. Now, when I wrote this, it was interesting to me. The word priestless was tagged as not being a real word. It's not. And so I thought, you know, I'm not sure about the word, but I think the concept is incorrect. So, yeah, we sisters offered a sacramental ministry. We used, generally, pre-consecrated hosts. But everyone knew that that was not the real presence that was happening. The real presence happened when people would come with a poncho of a recently deceased person, put it before the altar, and fill it with that person's favorite food and coca leaves. It came with the groups who participated in baptizing a child, when they anointed the child, when they put more water on the child, I didn't know what I was doing when I invited them to hold the candle in front of the child. People took up to 3 or 4 minutes with that candle in front of that child. And I think, we're never going to get out of here. But their imagination was changing. They were participating. In the processions, carrying the image of the Christ Lord from the cross, those were all the instances of genuine, real presence. The mutual presence of the people to God and one another, all bonded in a sacred community. I remember I also had a chance to teach in the seminary in the Andes. And I used a book that recounted the history of the Sacrament of Reconciliation, going from the time when there was great argument in the church about where you could if you could ever be forgiven for adultery, murder, or apostasy, to the time of, okay, that moved into a very long process, could be years to get back into the community. Then the monks go to Ireland, and murders and so on are happening so much that there's no chance to send anybody on this long journey, and there aren't enough priests, so they do confession and absolution. And then the penance takes a while, often a pilgrimage, so that the person gets out of town until people forget a little bit about what's happened. So then when that practice of confession and absolution went back to the continent, they said, that is wrong. That can never be done. That's counter to what we've always done. And then at Trent, the church declared that confession, absolution was the only valid way of performing the sacrament, saying that it's in line with our venerable tradition. So the thing is, our memory of venerable traditions can change. That's pretty obvious with MAGA, you know. But when I was doing that, when I was teaching in the Andes, I was teaching guys from various cultures, I realized that teaching was actually a bigger contribution than the sacramental ministry that I really loved. I was preparing guys who were Aymara or Quechua to minister to their own people. I was encouraging them to enculturate the sacraments and rituals into the rituals of their people. I loved the ministry that we did in parishes, but because I was not of that culture, I could never minister to the soul of the people the way their own could. So our mission task was to encourage the growth and depth of the faith of the people, and they had to be the ones to make it their own. Their challenge was to build up an authentic church, a church of liberation in Aymara and Quechua territory. So then I thought, well, that's my experience some time back. What about today? So I talked to one of our sisters, Yolanda Arribas Plata. If you can say that, it took me months, but we call her Yoli. Yoli lives in a parish that's humongous in the outskirts of Lima. It's a place called Canto Chico. There's a parish with 9 chapels, and a chapel is basically a mini parish, and it's not so many. So the priests don't have anything to do, any way to do it more than perform the sacraments and move on. So Yoli, talking to one of the younger priests, said, why don't you give me charge of a chapel? I'll organize the people, hold liturgical celebrations, adult and child catechesis, etc. He laughed. I thought, oh my God, was he embarrassed? Was he just speechless? Then later, in a meeting of all the pastoral ministers in the area, he asked her to take charge of one of the chapels while the priests were on vacation. And she replied that sisters are protagonists, not people to fill the gaps until something better comes along. Other sisters from the community sitting in that meeting stood up and applauded.
Oh, that's awesome.
So when we think about women's protagonism and what's going on in the church, one of the things that is very interesting to me is we see the numbers of associates or connections to religious communities mushrooming. In many religious communities, including the province I come from, we have more associates than vowed members. Why are they coming? Participating in the spirituality and mission of a religious community is giving people what many lack in their parishes. Community, people with whom to have a serious religious conversation, people with whom to pray, minister, and celebrate in creative and inclusive ways. Maybe sisters are somehow, not necessarily filling in the gaps, but in the forefront of things, ministering where no one else is yet. Now, from 1850 to 1965 or 70, women religious built the institutional church in the United States. That's a job that we did. It's done. Now, we're offering a nourishing alternative to the slim rations people are offered in too many parishes. We're not bound by the rubrics, and therefore, together with our neighbors, we can develop experiences that really feed the soul. And as I noted, the response has been significant. Last week, my congregational leadership team and I, we as a congregational leadership team, talked about the contribution we wanted to send in for the synod. Much of what we had to say was both sad and old news. Many young women are rejecting Catholicism because of its denigration of women. They know they are not called to be an add-on to what's already an almost perfect human race. They know that their gifts, especially if they have a vocation to ministry, will most likely go unappreciated and underused in this church. They know that while the church in Rome is promoting synodality, there are still only 54 women among the 364 members of the synod, the same as the number of cardinals. As Yoli says, we don't need complementarity, we want inclusion. So studies show that women might be more naturally collaborative, kind of synodal behaviors. And when, I forgot to mention the Ollas Comunes. Yoli is working among other sisters with women in the neighborhoods who, ever since COVID, when no work was available, you know, a lot of these people in these neighborhoods are making their living by selling candy on the street, by washing people's windows. We're seeing the Latin Americans bring that into the U.S. too now. But there was no chance to do anything, and there was no food. So Catholic Charities, international relief organizations, started sending food, and the women organized in what they called an olla común, an outdoor makeshift kitchen, basically a pot with something to heat it up, and cooked for the neighborhood. Anybody who needed could come and get something to take back home. Those women were organizing, and I asked Yoli, do they see themselves today as acting on Catholic social teaching or as part of their faith? And she said, not really. I mean, it's just natural. You know, they come from a communal culture, and it's absolutely natural to them. It, as one woman said to me, oh, sister, if you've ever been hungry, you don't want that for anybody else. And it's just what comes out of them. So I would say when the women are on the cooking fire of the olla común or a community of indigenous people studying scripture and opening their eyes to, she wasn't a prostitute. She was a leader. She represented her whole people and evangelized them. When they start to realize that sort of thing, all changes. And that was the work of the basic Christian communities in Latin America. And that's why they got in so much trouble with governments and church. So when these people around the cooking fire or in the study group hear interpretations that turn domination on its head, they perk up. They begin to imagine differently. We need to cultivate that kind of imagination so that, as that great song rendition of the Magnificat says, we can really say the world is about to turn. So, thank you.
Bringing their work into this room. It's very important to what we do and the interconnection of all of these issues.